third, you know, our third track of the course is really the most important. It's to be able to give an ethical analysis of a real problem. And so we're going to do this, hopefully in some depth. We'll have some time to talk today and Wednesday and next week. We'll have a process for the paper. We'll have a chance to get benefits from each other on peer review. So we're really doing something very different, but it's one of the most valuable things in the course, because what you can do with the resources in the course is to start developing your ethical worldview. And so that's a really exciting project when you feel that you have your bearings in ethical discussions across a wide range of topics, because you've kind of developed your thinking. And so that's the first point I want to make tonight, is that as we get into the position papers, it's really important for you to know that I see my job as helping you develop your view, not a view that I might hold. And so there are A papers across a wide range of positions, from we don't have an obligation at all, which is probably a hard position to develop, but I can help you develop an A paper on that, to we have very strong obligations. And really there's a lot of positions in between. So it's not, this topic is less likely to be an absolute yes-no topic rather than, what kind of obligation do we have. But you're welcome to develop any position that you're drawn to, and I'm here to help you do that. And we're all here, in a sense, to help each other develop our own positions, not simply to try to convince each other of our positions. Although that's part of the process, right? Is to say, well, you know, here's why I'm attracted to my position. Here are reasons that were compelling to me. Now you tell me about your position. And the goal doesn't always have to be to convince the person that you're right. But influence is not a bad thing, especially when it's done well. So we have two group experiences tonight and two small group experiences tonight. So I want to kind of get us moving toward those. First, let's talk about Singer a little bit, okay? So our study questions, just make sure you note them. The first two track the two main things I want you to get out of the Singer reading, so let's just kind of underline those right at the start. The first part of the article makes this kind of in-your-face argument that maybe not helping people is more like murder than you thought. Let's start our notes there. One of Singer's goals is he's got two goals in this paper. Let's just get them out on your notes. One goal is to show you that not helping people is more like killing them than you thought. But I need to add a very important caveat here. Students often miss this. He's not saying they're equivalent. That's really important. That would be a pretty rough position, hard position to defend. So not helping people and killing people are more alike than you might have thought, but they're not the same. That's really important. And you'll see it if you read carefully. He makes concessions. He makes that point-by-point comparison, and he makes concessions. He says, okay, no, it's not quite murder, but it's closer than you think. Second point is that this principle of not comparable significance, which we'll highlight, it's this principle. You'll recognize it immediately when I show you. Right? This principle, that if it's in our power to prevent something very bad from happening without thereby sacrificing anything of comparable moral significance, we ought to do it. And that's an interesting principle. He defends it. You don't have to agree with it, and you may even develop your position because you resist it. So I want you to locate both areas in this topic that you're drawn to and claims that you resist, because I want you to kind of work through your own position here. So that's the second thing that I think is important in that article. And then the third study question is just to understand what Sachs is up to, how we analyze the problem, and really how, I should have added, how hard would it be to reach the goal. Okay. So let's get to Singer. Let's get a little more work in on Singer, and then get to our first group experience. Okay, so I'm not going to take you through the 5 points that he considers in asking. question about whether not giving to the relief of absolute poverty is the moral equivalent of murder. But you have notes here to remind yourself about it. So there are, you know, plausibly five specific differences. So the argument works by locating the differences and then going to each one and saying, you know, this difference might not matter in a particular case, or this difference is kind of extrinsic to the moral problem. That's his basic claim. And so with each of these five, he kind of goes through and says why it doesn't make as big a difference as you might think. And so that's how he gets you to see his position, which is that the difference is not as big as you might think. It's not murder, but it's closer than you think. Any reactions to that? I mean, have you thought before about the difference between omissions and commissions? Because that's really what this is about at this level, right? Is not acting always categorically different ethically than acting? So, yeah. You want to see if you can take us into this a little bit? Maybe you don't have anything ready yet. That's fine.
Well, I think when you're omitting to act, you're still making an action, which is like you're choosing not to act.
Right.
So it is. Right. So like not acting is still an action.
Still an act, especially in knowledge, right? The more you know about the consequences of acting and not acting, the less dramatic the difference is, right? Yeah.
Also, you made a good point, like with the motive, like when you buy an iPod, the motive isn't to like not give that money to someone else. You're being selfish, but like your motive is different than someone. So like, your intention is different when you're like.
You might not have. So if I remember this context, you might not have an immoral intention. But you could also, your act could nevertheless, your omission could nevertheless have moral consequences. Is that kind of what you got out of that? We might be talking about the same section, I'm not sure. Yeah, good. Okay, so one way to clarify this is to say, okay, let's look at a thought experiment. What's going on here? Sorry about that. I'm stuck in some kind of mouse mode here.
Oh, this is a middle thing.
Is it that? Yeah, maybe it's that. Okay, good. So the thought experiment is really huge, and you know, for some reason I never put it in my notes. It's really irresponsible. But here's the negative part of the argument is to muddy the difference between omissions and commissions. And that's the murder equivalent of murder argument. But the positive part of the argument is to say, you know what, if it's within your power to prevent something really bad from happening and you don't have to give up something comparable, you ought to do it. And so here's this thought experiment, right? Remember, he's walking by the pond. Somebody want to take us into this? Yeah.
He has to go to lecture and he does it in nice suits. You see a child drowning in the pond and there's no one around to help them. So even though you're going to get the suit dirty, you're going to be late for lecture, you should still get to save the child.
Right, right. So omitting action in that case, he would say, is morally reprehensible because you don't have to give up anything significant to save a life. You might lose your shoes, right?
One thing that was kind of difficult about that comparison for me was just that the professor in that case was very clear to him that that person was drowning, or he was aware of the fact that
mm-hmm.
that was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, like, being reminded of the presence of that happening. So even, you can't walk around 24 hours out of the day being like, there are children in this country and in other countries who are dying of starvation, and I am partially to blame because of that. Like, you just simply can't. So in that situation, he's like very directly faced with
right.
the
Good.
Act that he's omitting.
Good. Yeah, I like what you're doing, because you're kind of saying, well, oh, sure, if it's like there, the kid's in the pond, I'm walking by. But that wouldn't apply to a global. So let's see if you guys agree with her second point, because I think you could say that. I wanted to see what Singer would say back.
I think the other
Yeah, and one of the things we're going to ask ourselves is are we talking about an individual obligation or a communal obligation? And that's going to make a big difference in your positions, whether you think this is...
So that kind of brings into like the concept, I forget what it's called, but where if there are a larger number of people, and like let's say that boy was drowning,
right,
it would be less likely to help kind of act. But again, if there's a single person there, they are more likely inclined to help
yeah.
the child.
You might be thinking of this thing in this phenomenon that we've labeled the Kitty Genovese effect. Have any of you heard of that? It's the tendency for people in a group not to come to the aid of someone because they assume somebody else is going to do it. But Kitty Genovese was famously, I think she was murdered in Boston, and there were people in the area where she was murdered, and when they interviewed them afterwards, they all thought somebody else was taking care of it. So groups have problems about responsibility in that sense. But yeah, that's one of the variables. So the thought experiment may or may not work for us, right? Laura's raised a criticism of it. It kind of works if it's something that's in your face, but maybe would that mean that it wouldn't apply to helping people thousands of miles away from us that we don't see? What do you think?
I think there's also a difference because you can see the direct result and know that it's been solved
right.
when you save the boy or the little kid, but when you're donating money,
And he takes that on, right? Because a good reason not to take on an obligation is if you have no rational means of knowing that you're helping, right? Suppose it was completely random whether the dollar you sent was doing any good. That would be a good reason to be skeptical about the obligation. So one of the things we're going to want to ask ourselves in our research phase here, you know, Wednesday we're going to, I should explain that actually, is we're going to, you should ask ourselves, what contemporary evidence do we have about the effectiveness of this? Because notice if, so there's the kid in the pool, and then the analogy is made to, especially kids in absolute poverty. And you might say, well, Laura, you made a strong statement, if I heard it right. These can never be equated, right? Because these people are very far away, we don't really see them, and the thought experiment is about coming across something that you can do. But notice knowledge, ability, and having it in your face, those could all be features of the remote situation, don't you think?
Yeah, so what I would argue is not that they... I don't think that they're the same. I think that the thought experiment could be used to like aid the reasoning for the other.
Right.
So I think the reasoning that most people go around not thinking about it is because they either don't have the knowledge base
right.
or have the knowledge base and aren't very frequently shown the kind of reality
right.
of it.
Right.
And it's not commonplace. Like, it's not commonplace in our society to, like, go up to your friend and be like, did you donate $3 today to Africa?
Well,
how you
do it is a further matter. You're absolutely right to be skeptical about how far the point from the thought experiment transfers to the case that it was meant to.
Can I offer, like, a more comparable thought experiment, kind of considering what they said? It'd be, like, more if, let's say you're walking alone, and I guess you could say that like the park, and all of a sudden somebody comes by and says, help, there's a kid in the pool, and there's a kid going in the pool, and you see something in the pool, and you're not
right.
sure that it's, you're not sure that there's actually a kid drowning, it could be a swan.
I see what you're doing, yeah, that makes sense.
But you have the option to, should I risk the possibility of going and inconveniencing myself
Right. Yeah. So see, what I hear you doing here is good. It's, you're sort of imagining. Well, what if my knowledge were imperfect? Is that a kid or is it like a predator that might hurt me? what if I wasn't sure about my ability? You know, if the pool's only 2 feet, I think I can do it. But what if it might stretch my abilities? You know, what if it's really deep and there's currents in it? You know, and the proximity to my awareness is. You know, that can, how much that matters is an open question, because that's a form of knowledge, right? You don't have to have pictures of starving kids on your computer all the time to know that there are people starving and dying every day, right? So knowledge and direct and kind of affective, the in-your-face thing is kind of like affective knowledge, right? Anti-poverty programs got their start partly because in the 60s and 70s we started showing people images of people in absolute poverty, and it triggered a real empathy response. And so so that is a relevant factor. But now that we've developed, you know, after 60 years of serious efforts to alleviate absolute poverty, we have a knowledge base. We haven't always succeeded. In some cases, we've actually failed miserably. But in some cases, we have succeeded. And so there's this knowledge base that you guys get to dive into to help form your positions. Because you're right, you do need to know. You need answers to a lot of questions about how effective the aid would be. Hang on, let's just see where we are. So let's just focus on this principle right now. So how it would play out. So if it's in our power to prevent something very bad from happening without thereby sacrificing anything of comparable moral significance, we ought to do it. What's the phrase in there that we need to know about? Yeah.
I think it's the without thereby sacrificing.
Right.
That's like the crucial thing.
Right. Right. That's what's doing all the work.
Yeah.
Right. So can we get a little list going in your notes? Mm-hmm. So we've already talked about the parents who take the college fund and send it to an organization, right? So we need some data points to think about comparable moral significance. So that's on your list, right? You have the example of the family from the Singer article that sold their house and moved into a smaller house. They didn't think they were giving up something of comparable moral significance. Apparently they were in a pretty big house to begin with, because they realized an $800,000 equity from going to a smaller house. What if a parent said, you get your college fund, but, we're not going to buy you a car in college. So maybe that's an obvious luxury, right? Give me a couple more. We need examples where you could test your intuitions about what's comparable moral significance. Oh, your latte, giving up a latte. Giving up, reducing a luxury that you enjoy in more than a minimal way. Maybe you go to 5 concerts a year. Maybe you could go to 4, right? So these are data points that I want you to kind of check your intuitions. What would be something that isn't comparable that I could easily do? Yeah.
I think the other thing, too, and one issue I kind of found within this is it was always kind of like a either-or, or like omitting something or not purchasing something so you can spend that money on something else when you kind of have this idea of a set amount of income. Because, like, for example, say you have a certain amount of income and you need to buy a certain amount of food, and each week within that food you have to buy a chocolate bar. You could spend your money
have
on...
Have to buy a chocolate bar?
This is like a very, like,
yeah,
not
sure.
A good example.
Sure, that's
but
okay.
I'm coming up.
Go ahead. Go for it. Go for it.
So you could buy that Hershey's chocolate bar,
okay,
which is the cheapest one,
right,
and then spend that money somewhere else. Or you could buy a fair trade chocolate bar where the whole money is going
right
to, like, a good cause. So I feel like you can't just think of money you're admitting. You
good
have to think about the money that you're spending, even... the money that you quote-unquote think you, like, have
good
to spend.
Yeah, so there's within the budget, cool, there's trade-offs, is what I hear you saying. And,
yeah.
And you gain, right.
Absolutely. Yeah, whereas I felt like this article only focused on omissions.
Well,
as, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, he talked about a lot of things. I mean, but that's certainly one of them. I mean, think about the logic of this. You know, suppose you use the $100,000 that your parents saved for college the way many of you are using it, right? And you're going to have a better income. So arguably, you're going to be in a better position to help people in absolute poverty if you can be a relatively high income earner. So you can imagine saying, well, no, that wouldn't be giving up something, that would be giving up something of comparable moral significance, because my ability to help people in poverty would be hindered if I didn't develop my talents. You hear that argument?
Mm-hmm.
So what's harder to do is to say, is to justify the yacht and the mansion, the second mansion, right? And, you know, okay, so you've endowed your kids' future and their grandkids' future. You know, wonderful. That's great. I think that's something people want to do. But above that, What would the argument be that your second 100 million is comparable, morally comparable to saving people's lives?
And I feel like part of that is some of the things you can teach, like, your children,
mm-hmm.
is not even about money, and, like, it's not even a matter of, like, omitting stuff. It's a matter of, like, teaching them to have those morals that they would want to go out and
right.
help after they have, like, an education.
Right.
And so I feel like some of it doesn't even cost anything.
Yeah, if you take the testimony of the family that sold their house, you could make the argument that by not giving, you're giving up something of great significance, which is the possibility of being an effective altruist. People who do this often report that they get a tremendous reward from it, that they hadn't anticipated. Giving money actually kind of feels good in a lot of ways if you think you're giving it to an effective organization. Okay, so here's what, there's no way we're going to, I mean, it wouldn't be useful, a good use of our time to really track all the details in this argument, but I want it to be really clear that you should come back to this argument, back to this article, especially the end, because he considers counterposition. So if you're drawn to, many of you should be drawn to some of the counterarguments here, and so you might want to look at his response to them and see if you can come up with criticize that response. The point is that you need to be interested in arguments and counter-arguments throughout this. You can't just develop your position and make it really strong without thinking about the best arguments from other positions. Does that make sense? Okay, so that means that when you get into small groups, you should really be listening to each other and encouraging each other to express the difference here. And so I have a little pitch I need to give you about this. This used to come up at the end of my course. You know, I used to wait to do the applied work till the end. And you can imagine the logic, right? I felt like if you had most of the course under your belt, you'd be able to do a better analysis. Now I've moved this pretty early in the semester. And the reason is because I think you need more experience doing this. I think when it comes up at the end of the semester, it's too rushed. But I also think that once you get the reading of the course done, especially Haidt's book, you start to look at ethics differently. And I really wanted to wait until you had that whole argument before you do an applied topic. So I'm a little nervous about that, but I'm just going to tell you a couple of things you probably already figured out and just make a couple of notes to remind yourself. One is the view that Haidt is going to give you. I'll give you a note on this, okay? A claim he's going to defend... is a central claim he's going to defend is viewpoint diversity. Okay, I'll say this twice. Viewpoint diversity is a population phenomenon. Moral viewpoint diversity. Moral viewpoint diversity is a population phenomenon in Haidt's theory. And you'll see this, you know, I think it'll be persuasive. It's been persuasive to a lot of students. What that means is diversity of viewpoint is like other traits that are distributed in a population of humans. So just as eye color is a trait that you find, you know, distributed according to genetics in a population, and other preferences, so also our moral viewpoints actually have a dimension to them that our moral viewpoints are related to traits that are part of our personality. We're going to learn about this. I'm not trying to persuade you of this right now. The reason I'm bringing it up now is that when you get into small groups, you should be excited to discover viewpoint difference. You should not be thinking, I've got to convince the people in my small group that I'm right. You should represent your views to the extent that they're just developing. I wouldn't be surprised if many of you didn't have a position yet. But my point is to say that the view of ethics, the meta-ethics, where we're going in meta-ethics in the course, is that viewpoint diversity is normal. It's not something we have to get past by convincing each other that there's one right answer. We're going to come to the view, I think, that that's not how ethics work. The second point I want to make, so I'm nervous about that because we haven't had a chance to do all 12 or 13 weeks of that study. The second point is just this image from when you get into your group. I want you to be thinking of this wonderful image in Socrates' Platonic Dialogues of philosophy as midwifery. You know what midwives are, right? midwives are traditionally women who help women deliver their babies. And it's a very odd image, because classic Greek philosophy is so male-centered. It's just amazing that in the middle of it, you get Socrates saying, you know, doing philosophy is sort of like being a midwife. Now, what does he mean? What we should be doing when we work with each other philosophically is we should be trying to deliver each other's theories. You hear it?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a cool image. Your job is to help people deliver their ideas as healthy theories. And that's a different model than the kind of... there's plenty of room for debates and who won, and you know, that makes sense. I'm not against that. But in the context of our work, I think you should see yourselves as helping each other develop each other's position, not your position, right? So that means a couple of very specific things. You know, ask questions, suggest alternatives, watch your rhetoric. Use the kind of rhetoric that invites people to share their difference with you, not the kind of rhetoric that leads people to run for cover, right? It's great to be convinced passionately of the truth of your position, and you should represent that in your discussions with each other. But you need to make sure that you're really being a good philosopher in the sense of midwifery. You're helping each other develop your views. Now, this is a very preliminary discussion, so in this small group work, I don't want you to feel like you need to have worked out positions with each other. I want you to just, this is the prompt for the small group work. Which ideas or theories in your reading were you drawn to? Which were you resisting? Just locating that right at the beginning of a philosophical inquiry is really important. Which ideas in the readings, which viewpoints in the readings were you drawn to? Which were you resisting? And even though Singer argues for his viewpoint most of the article, he does consider a pretty wide range of objections. So some of those might be things you were drawn to or resist. And I want you to just initially share with each other some of the places that you go to think about this problem. And just to give you a couple of more concepts to help with that, we've said, for example, that you might develop a no obligations view. There's an A paper with that view. You might wonder whether the obligation is individual or communal. A communal obligation is one that we are comfortable imposing on a group, on members of a group, right? So taxation to defend the country is something that virtually every moral political philosophy accepts. You have to pay, you know, if you're going to enjoy defense, you have to pay some taxes. But sometimes we say, the obligation to help people in need is an individual duty. It's not a communal duty. Do you hear that difference? We sometimes say that helping people is praiseworthy, but not obligatory. That's an interesting difference, right? Some of you may develop a position where you say, well, it's a good thing to do, but it's not a duty. There's a lot. Can you think of some other things that are morally good to do but not duties? Well, you have a duty not to kill people. Remember that. Yeah.
Picking up dog
poop. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. Service to the community beyond the call of duty. Right? That's there's a kind of pun there, too, right? You're doing good. Okay. Yeah, good. So some things are praiseworthy. There's a fancy term in ethics called supererogatory. They're beyond the call of duty. Okay, so see, these are concepts that you might use to help you locate your proto-positions. I don't think you can even see yourself having positions. So you might have a position already. Maybe you've thought about this a lot and read about it. Okay, let's give this 5 to 7 minutes in small groups. Make sure you introduce yourselves, get caught up on your weekend, and see where y'all are. Think of the poor cabin boy that those people ate. You know, I mean, triage situations can lead to cannibalism, right? Yeah, absolutely. One thing your comment kind of got me thinking about, I should add to your comment, is the dramatic triage argument is what if we are in a lifeboat, right? if you take a look at population, if you think about population a certain way, you know, then yeah, helping people survive could be leading to a greater disaster later. Now, he gives you some arguments for resisting that, but it is true that every innovation we've made in, I took some exception this time around to some of the things he says about food. Every innovation we've made in increasing food production has, in fact, led to dramatic population increase. So there is a logic to that triage concern. But you remember what he argues is there's also an enduring pattern that as countries become wealthier, their birth rate goes down. So if you can get over that transition, there's this phenomenon, demographic transition, is that the term? Where, you know, finally Catholics in the U.S. were the last holdouts, you know. I mean, I had three siblings, you know. Finally Catholic family size is coming down, you know. So, but they were like one of the last groups to really resist that
equation.
Okay, other things? Attracted to, resisting, suspicious of, skeptical of, want to know more about?
Well, one thing that we briefly talked about was with the idea of, like, property rights and sort of being able
right.
to have, like, keep your income to create, like, this buffer of safety.
Yeah.
And we sort of talked about how that's, like, a very American, like, individualistic value that we hold. And so, like, looking at the difference between, like, more communal and individualistic values, like we were talking about, like, a few
yeah.
weeks ago.
Good.
And, like, how that impacts, like, whether or not people help other countries and people in poverty.
Yeah, we tend to have low inheritance tax. We tend to see wealth accumulation as intergenerational. You can pass money. Why not endow the great-great-grandkids, you know? And that is a very individualistic cultural phenomenon. One of the things we'll notice, we might as well bring it up now, in the Sachs article, right? You know, there's this discussion about the 0.7% GDP target for giving. And this target was agreed to back in the 70s. Only four countries have reached it. They're all Northern European capitalist countries. They're all the most sociocentric capitalist country, wealthy countries in the world. I don't think there's an accident that those countries found it easier to get to 0.7 than more individualistic wealthy countries. Right? Yeah.
We actually talked about that too because there's such a different demographic in those countries than, like, say, the United States.
How so? Yeah, good.
Those countries just have, like, a significantly smaller population.
Right. Right.
And it's significantly, like, there's not so much of a degree of viewpoints
good.
In there.
So they're more there's less political diversity. There's more when you meet people in the Netherlands, you know, they have a more similar mental outlook, political outlook. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's some others. I think I was gonna add that, I just forgot. Yeah. Good. Yeah.
I'd like to learn more. I think it was this paper where he's talking about, like, the responsibility because of, like, the exploitation that Western Europe had on, like,
yeah, I want us to get into this under the heading of complicity. Yeah, good. Good. Let me get there in a couple minutes. Yeah. Good. Let me go through this in two things that I want to give you more detail on. As you were thinking, I was just thinking about things that might come up. And, you know, one thing that came up for me is I'm drawn to the idea that the more trivial the burden and the more dramatic the benefit, the harder it is to deny the obligation. Like, if I could solve absolute poverty by pulling the coins out of my pocket, you know, and given the discrepancy between the vastly wealthy part of the world and the absolute poor, you know, if I could do it with just my chump change, my pocket change, you know, God, why wouldn't I, you know? But I'm also drawn to this idea of live and let live, you know? Let's all try to... It's not so long ago that we were food insecure. It's not so long ago that we had many diseases to be worried about and so on. So, you know, you might say that this attitude really has some strength to it in our history, is that, you know, it's been an accomplishment for humans to get to this stage, you know, to live and let live. So you might kind of appreciate that getting beyond it might be hard. I think a lot of people resist the idea that giving has become very effective. There are failures, but we'll talk about, you know, effectiveness of giving a little bit in a few minutes. But the more theoretical point I wanted to give you some notes on is this. Okay, so let's drill down on this together. I want you to appreciate that having a rights view doesn't really settle the issue, right? Because some rights views are more consequentialist and some rights views are non-consequentialist. So let's take a look at some differences. If we met this guy Nozick when we were talking about libertarianism, right? So if your rights view is that, if your view is that rights separate us, they separate us into individual spheres of action, and they determine when someone can make a claim on me. Then the libertarian view of rights, the highly individualistic view of rights, is that aiding others can be an individual duty, but it can never be the source of a claim that others have against me. You hear that? So this would be, it would be, could be individually praiseworthy for a Nozickian or for a libertarian. It could be praiseworthy to be generous, but nobody has a claim on me that they can say that they have a right to my aid. Do you hear that? In the libertarian model? But you could make the argument that people do have a right to aid under certain circumstances. And Kant, interestingly enough, that's why we squeezed him in last week, right? Kant has an interesting argument about this, because he actually addresses this way back in, like, 1800. He asked this question. Would it be irrational for me to deny myself aid under emergency conditions? Put that in your notes. Would it be irrational for me to deny myself aid from others under extreme conditions? And he says, yes, it would be. You know, he imagines a person who hates getting help from others, just hates it, like doesn't want to get any help from anybody. And he's on the brink of starving, right? And what Kant wants to say is that person is not honoring reason in themselves. It's irrational to deny yourself aid just because you don't like getting it. You don't like the idea of getting it. And he's not saying you'll be happier by accepting the aid, because this, the person who hates getting help is actually less happy when people help them. But he's alive. She's alive. And the point that Kant makes is you're not treating yourself as a source of rational life plans if you deny yourself emergency aid from others. But if that's true, okay, has everybody got the first point? No? I'm not seeing a lot of nonverbal. Okay. So it's irrational to deny yourself aid from others under emergency conditions, even if it makes you really upset to accept the aid, because you're not honoring reason in yourself. You're a source of rational plans. But if that's true, then you can't universalize the maxim that says live and let live. Because if it's irrational to deny yourself that, then it would be irrational to say, let's treat the whole world. Remember this moment of universalization in Kant. Can I universalize the maxim? Can I rationally will a world in which everybody takes a live and let live attitude? He says, no, that would be irrational. For the same reason, it's irrational to deny yourself the aid. You would not be treating others as rational beings. The point isn't to make people happier for Kant. He's giving a non-consequentialist rights view that supports aid on the basis that it's irrational to deny it to yourself. And if that's irrational, you can't universalize it to everybody. Another way of looking at it, okay, is that... I'm seeing a little.
It's irrational to give aid to everybody?
If it's irrational to deny aid to yourself under emergency conditions, then it's irrational to universalize the principle live and let live. Okay? We can talk about that some more. We're not in a hurry. Yeah?
So if it's irrational to deny ourselves aid, it's irrational to deny others of aid. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because that's how you would do it. You'd universalize the live and let live maxim and say, hey, you know, good luck to everybody, you know, but nobody has a claim on me to aid. Yes?
I think the confusion is coming from the fact that we haven't defined what live and let live is.
Oh, good. Then maybe that's helpful. Yeah, no, that would be the idea that I won't act. Oh, yeah, I should unpack that. Thank you. I won't act to hurt anybody else, but I won't be obligated to help anybody. Live and let live. Good, thank you. So the live and let live maxim, when generalized, leads basically to the Nozickian position, libertarian position, that, you know, nobody's got a claim on me. Let's get back to this idea that it's irrational to deny yourself the receipt of aid. You know, another way to see this is to think about insurance. Kant didn't live in a time when you could insure against losses, but he would have loved insurance, right? You see why? You see why? Why? Somebody try to say in your own words. Why would Immanuel Kant love insurance? Makes the world, yeah, makes, you want to try it?
Because it's a rational decision to insure or to prepare for, like, what could happen.
It makes the world more rational. That would be his answer. And specifically, it makes the world more predictable, less unpredictable. So you can't predict that your house, whether your house is going to burn down, but you can make it predictable that you'll be able to build a new one if you insure it, right? I love insurance, by the way. I pay lots of money in insurance. I hope I never have any claims. That's, people have trouble with that, but, you know, I'm getting it. Every time I pay that premium, I'm a happy guy. Why? Because, you know, because it's like, well, what are the things we fear? The things that we can't recoup our lives from, the things that would disrupt any of our plans. You hear the rationality of life plans in that? So for Kant, insurance, this is a kind of insurance policy. It would be irrational to deny yourself help in dire circumstances just because you subscribe to this principle. Yeah, and then over here.
Maybe
so,
like an example of that he would not like would be physician-assisted suicide.
Right.
Like someone, like, wants to kill themselves.
Right.
And
he does actually argue against assisted suicide. Kant does. Yeah.
Okay.
So you got the right punch there. Good. Yeah.
Just going back to the insurance thing.
Sure.
Could it, like, you also argue, though, that, like, is it ethical to spend all this money on insurance for things that I don't even know is going to happen?
Right.
Like, when I could be putting that money towards something that would actually help someone who has issues now.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point. You could. I mean, that's an equation. That's exactly the kind of. That's one kind of equation I need you to work through there. Yeah, think about that. You know, we made the argument that it might make sense for you to use your college fund to develop your talents because then you could help more people. So you might, I mean, just off the top of my head, you might say, well, insurance is similar. The more I can even out the unpredictability of life, the more reliably I can help. I mean, that's one reason I would say I pay insurance, because I want to be able to help my family. You know, forget about the absolutely poor for a minute. I want to be able to help my family, and my ability to do that is going to be impaired if I can't insure. Yeah, Laura.
I think it's a little difficult to compare it to, like, giving as, like, insurance, because, I mean, I know I have innate privilege that will completely prevent me from ever getting into the position of being someone in.
The odds are thin, but it can happen, Laura. I need to bring this to your attention. You could get into that position. It's possible to go from absolute wealth to absolute poverty. It's just very rare. You're right.
But I mean, within the context of the privilege that I have, you can't always use that argument, because, I mean, if you are in America, like he was saying within this argument that poor people in America are not innately like poor people in another country. So that kind of idea that you're giving to those poor people in another country because you don't want to become them, if you don't have a plan on ever.
I see,
going,
right.
You know,
if it's vanishingly small probability that you'll become poor, then you might rationally, I like that. Then you might rationally, contra Kant, you might rationally say, I don't need the insurance policy. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. But you know, maybe I'm just kind of a fearful person, but there are a lot of bad things that can happen. People get sick. It wipes them out. It wipes out their wealth. It hurts their families. You know, bad things happen. So I don't know. I mean, it's certainly something to consider. One last point before we get into second small group. Let's just talk about complicity. Riley, you mentioned this kind of... there's a page I want to kind of get in your notes. It's 199. So So we tend not to think that... Nope, that's not one thing. I'm sorry. It's, I'll find it. It's 197. Singer makes the claim, put it in your notes, that we have a kind of complicity in the condition of the absolute poor. And you might say, what do you mean, complicity? They're all the way over there. I have nothing to do with them. I haven't caused their poverty. Well, do you remember what he says? In what sense might we be complicit in maintaining people in absolute poverty? Anybody remember the detail here? I can help with it. I remember it. We get, for example, there's several examples. Oh. Yeah, you got it?
Yeah, they're poor, your dollar can buy more over there.
Say it again?
If they're poor, the country's poor, you can generally buy more with the dollar over there in the country.
Right. Let me see if this, maybe come back with it if you think it's wrong. Yeah?
Like the example of oil and dictatorship.
Yeah, we tolerate exploitive dictators who give us access to natural resources in their country at a low price. If we look the other way when they put the money in the Swiss bank account, there's plenty of stories of that, especially in Africa. So we have a finance system that allows that to happen. We tolerate it. We benefit from it. That's the point. We are complicit in some ways in the absolute poverty, in absolute poverty. Now, a more difficult example would be our use of labor from absolutely poor places, right? One argument is that this is another kind of complicity, that we are exploiting this wage. If most of the clothes we're wearing were not made in this country, right? The counter-argument, of course, is that many countries escape poverty through economic development. Put it in your notes. Economic development is the biggest anti-poverty program in the world. It's much more effective than anything else, except that it doesn't always happen. That's the problem. So, you know, So the counter-argument is that letting people in Cambodia make our underwear is actually helping them get there. And you could look at examples that seem to pan out in both directions. Cases where we seem to be supporting something like slave labor, denial of kids' education because they're in the labor market, and cases where countries have actually produced sustainable growth because they kickstart their economy from wealthy countries sending them business, right? So this is very live in the discussion today about fair trade in this country. You know, there really is evidence on both sides of this, okay? All right, here's what I'd like you to do in your last group experience. It's going to be 5 minutes. Just want to try to do it efficiently, and we'll get through it. I'd like you to get back together, and instead of sharing your initial views about obligations to alleviate poverty, I'd like you to generate a list of research needs. Because Wednesday's class, I should have pointed this out. For Wednesday's class, your assignment is going to be to update the Aid to Absolutely Poor wiki page, which is on the wiki site. I'd like you to post to the wiki page. There's going to be a lot of posts because there's like 64 of us. There's the earlier section too. It's going to be a messy page by Tuesday night. Don't worry. Don't freak out. Don't try to read it. Two assignments for Wednesday. Post hopefully by early Tuesday evening. We can't be perfect at this, but post ideally by early Tuesday evening on a research issue that you decide to pursue, which we're going to generate a list for now, right, in your small groups, and then try to read Tuesday night, read through the wiki page as much as you can, click through. So could you get into small groups and ask yourself things you want to know more about, things you need to look up, things that we should put on our, and we'll generate a little research list here. Okay. 5 minutes and we'll be there.
I love that.
Maybe a minute. Okay, I'll do that. Okay, guys, let's compare notes a little bit. You can stay in your groups if you want. So let's generate this research list, because that's what I'd like you to work off of when you decide what it is to post on the wiki. Give me some items.
We talked about, like, in the US, you want to know, like, the actual number of, you know, children in poverty,
right,
families in poverty, and then,
right,
what would be a substantial amount of money to live off of in a year.
Oh, good.
So you can kind of look at, like,
right,
okay, this is how much money someone actually needs to live off of.
Good.
Because I think as college students, we don't totally grasp that.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. So more information about U.S. relative poverty and versus absolute poverty. That's good. Absolutely. Yeah. I won't write all these down just to keep us moving. Yeah.
Well, we talked about,
yeah,
like, there's a sharp increase in people who are not in extreme poverty.
Yeah.
And, like, we're wanting to research what is working, like, what is,
yeah,
leading to this.
Yeah. Or you could ask two questions. You could ask that question, you know, what's causing the good news? This is good news, right? This is extraordinary good news. And you could also, yeah, so you could be asking it that way, but you could also, there's a skeptical argument that comes out of this. Hey, maybe this is going to happen on some. You know, you could say, yeah, just take a few more years, just extrapolate that function. Or maybe not. Maybe this is going to plateau. Maybe it'll go back up. One thing you might want to know of is how much accountability, how precise are we in assessing the effectiveness of anti-poverty programs? And I'll just give you one note on that real quick. Before 20 years ago, there was almost no effort to determine whether giving to the absolute poor helped or not. the idea was just, let's give, right? You can see that in the history of anti-poverty programs. In the last 20 years, some very smart people have applied some of the tests that we use to determine drug effectiveness, right? Random controlled studies for drug effectiveness. We've applied some of the tests that we use for that to anti-poverty programs. I can share some books with you about this. When I used to take a group to Benin in West Africa, anti-poverty relief was a big focus of the program. And so there's some really interesting work done recently on asking whether the programs have helped, to get back to your question, have the programs helped to reduce that, or have other things done it? Good, yeah. I think we're a little heavy in Singer. I think we need more anti-Singer arguments. Could you add that to your list? Anytime you feel like you're getting a lot on one side and you're not getting much on the other side, you should be like looking for the other side. I think we should be getting more anti-giving arguments. Not that maybe you'll be persuaded by them. I don't know. Maybe there's better anti-giving arguments than I'm aware of right now. I think we need more information on progress to date. There is some of that on the wiki page. I think we need to know a little more about volume of private giving versus government giving. Because after all, if you want to say it's an individual duty but not a communal duty, this data might be relevant, right? The more you can convince yourself that private giving will do the job, the less you might feel the need to say that it's a communal responsibility. Right? Others? Anything else? Yeah, Laura.
How people decide what organizations to give to, because, I mean, kind of feeding off of, like, what is working,
yeah,
but
right.
Also, like, what are people so right. emotionally drawn to that, you know, like,
yeah.
your people aren't going to donate to...
The psychology, it kind of goes under the heading of the psychology of giving. It may turn out that private giving is less effective because people are triggered by emotional responses and they're more likely to give to organizations that are not held accountable. It could be governments might be in a better position internationally to you know, create accountable programs because it won't just be a heartthrob issue like seeing a picture of a poor kid. Gabby, did you have something?
Oh, I was just going to do comparing like the extreme poverty lines, maybe like in capitalist and socialist countries, and see how that differs.
Yeah, yeah. It'd be interesting to know how different forms of economy fare in lifting people out of poverty. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, one small thing that I didn't do, just to remind you, I mean, you read the Sachs article, but I just want to kind of underscore one thing that relates to the study question here. There are two things in the Sachs article I just want to tag. One is, it's important that he shows you how the analysis gets done to estimate the need, the resource need. And so that's something I don't think many of you would have encountered yet, and I hadn't encountered until I started studying this. The second thing he does is to show just how trivial it would be for the U.S. to meet its 0.7 goal. I mean, remember at the end of the article, just in case you missed this or didn't quite get to it, if you take the 400 wealthiest people in this country, they make more than the combined incomes of all the people in four poor African countries, and Botswana, Nigeria, Senegal, and Uganda. And more to the point, if you just hadn't sunsetted the tax cuts that the Bush administration made in these 3 years, we would have met our 0.7 goal just off the 400 wealthiest people who benefited from that tax cut. So that's just how, I think it's great news here. That's just how fantastically wealthy we are. Isn't that great news? Really, I mean, I don't let a day go by without acknowledging to myself that I'm living in one of the wealthiest places in the world. So fantastically wealthy that arguably, and this, we can debate this, right? Arguably, if Sachs is right, we wouldn't even notice it. We wouldn't even notice it. So that depends on a lot of ifs, if the programs are effective. But the raw calculation about how much money is needed and how hard it would be to get that money from the wealthy countries, that Sachs article does that in a pretty reliable way. He's a pretty highly... People disagree with him, have different philosophies about poverty alleviation, so that's fair, but I've never read in print a dispute about these numbers, and they're pretty dramatic because it suggests that we're pretty close to the example I gave you where, you know, you pull up some coins and you take care of the problem. Okay, let's ask. The assignment for Wednesday. Is that what you're going to ask me?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm going to send an email reminder about this. If I don't, remind me. But the assignment is to identify resources that address our research needs, post them to the wiki page, hopefully by early Tuesday evening. Second assignment, read the wiki page.
Do you want a description or just
like... if you follow the pattern that you see there, definitely a description. The pattern you'll see there is that people posted a little... a little sentence, and then they put the link at the end. And if you can group it, I'll do some of that too. Okay. Do the number. Look at the number. What it's actually. Go get some other numbers. You get it. I was looking for the number per person. Like, is it $10 a year? $100? But it'll vary depending on how wealthy you are.
My bad.
Thank you.
See you Wednesday. Take care. Yeah.
You said it has like 5 minutes like that, but it hasn't. It only works for like 3 of the days.
This is to find the reading?
For the audio files.
Oh, are you having trouble getting make the links work? I'm worried about that.
It only works for like the 23rd, the first day of class, and I think the 31st.
Send me a couple of dates. Send me one or two dates that are in front of you, and then I'll look at the URL for that, see, because I might have just named the file.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'll just come and talk to you in your office Monday.
One?
Should I just have what I want to write about based on the wiki articles?
Well, I mean,
and
you want to talk about this person? Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Well, whatever. I just want to know what I should have prepared. That's good.
Well, your goal was to make sure that you were on track because you're going to miss Wednesday, right?
Yeah, I'm just going to miss the Wednesday night class,
sure.
So I don't want to.
Yeah, so that'll be the goal.
I feel like I'm missing because of a thing that I've decided to do.
Absolutely.
So.
No, it's good. That would be, if we're not going to have a quiz Wednesday, but if we were to have one.